Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Atrium Health merges with another hospital. Again, if approved, it will become the fifth largest hospital system in the country. The rumblings over the firing of school superintendent Ernest Winston continue bubbling over during an emergency school board meeting. Meanwhile, CMS, the city of Charlotte, and the governor are all making budget suggestions. We go into a few of the highlights. And school board member Rhonda Cheek, former city council members James Smudgy Mitchell, and wait for it, Madison Cawthorn, all make the news. Again, we'll share it. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE's political reporter, Steve Harrison. Good morning, Steve.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Nick Oxner is with us. He's WBTV's chief investigative reporter and executive producer of Investigations. Morning, Nick.
Morning, happy Friday the 13th.
Yeah. We'll see how it goes today. Jonathan Lowe is a reporter anchor for Spectrum News One. Jonathan, thank you for being here.
Of course. Good morning, Mike.
And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, back for a second time this week. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
So Atrium Health announced another merger this week with Aurora Health, which will expand Atrium's influence into the Midwest. And for that, we turn for the moment to WFAE's healthcare reporter, Claire Donnelly. Good morning, Claire.
Good morning.
Atrium has merged in the past. It has attempted mergers that have not taken place. How long has this one been in the works?
I don't know how long it's been in the works, and I also don't know how long it will take the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, to complete its federal review of it. But as you said in your intro, it's huge, right? It's a big deal if it gets approved.
This merger is with Midwest-based advocate Aurora Health. Why are both parties interested in getting together?
I mean, I think this is just part of a growing trend of hospital consolidation, right? There's just a lot of hospitals across the country that are doing what they call strategic combinations. There is a potential that they can make more money. Although in this case, I'm not sure how likely that is. We do know from like a lot of national studies that when hospital systems combine, they can charge higher prices. It's not clear in this case whether that will happen because Advocate Aurora is based in the Midwest and Atrium obviously is based in Charlotte. So having that geographic might,
We'll talk about the economic impact of that in just a couple of seconds, but the headquarters is going to stay here in Charlotte, but the name of the umbrella organization is going to be Advocate Health. Why the name? Our system will still be Atrium, but why the name change for the umbrella organization?
I mean, I think it just has to do with them negotiating, you know, merger negotiations, which I'm not privy to. But I do, they are going to keep Advocate Aurora, I know, in Wisconsin and Illinois, and then, like you said, it'll stay Atrium here locally. But
do we know who approached whom?
I don't know.
Okay. The merger will create, as I said, the fifth largest hospital system in the country with more than 1,000 care sites and 67 hospitals across Alabama, Georgia, Illinois, North and South Carolina, and Wisconsin. And the hospital says, as you just pointed out, that this will cut consumer costs. Has that proven to be the case in other hospital mergers?
No. I mean, by and large, no, based on, like I said, national studies of hospital consolidation. If you think about it, the more and more, you know, big systems gobble up smaller hospitals, the less competition there is, therefore, you know, kind of fish in a barrel in terms of what you can charge insurance companies.
And Eugene Woods, who is Atrium's CEO, says the merger will, quote, create more jobs and opportunities for our teammates and communities. Mergers usually result in some layoffs as duplication of services is reduced. Given the fact that we have two fairly distinct hospital systems in terms of their geographic footprint, is that likely to happen? Are layoffs likely to happen? Except at the CEO level.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, keep in mind, there's also this med school that's in the works. So I think that, you know, that will create jobs there. You know, they because of another merger with Wake Forest Baptist, Charlotte's going to get a med school. So,
and I'm not should sure say that this merger, like, this merger does not affect the med school at all. Eugene Woods, law school, Duke Law School professor Barack Richmond says, quote, "This does not point to a new frontier of competition. It points to a new scale of lack of competition, a new scale of monopoly power." And he says he believes consolidation this large could mean higher prices, suppressed wages for nurses and physicians, and more expensive national insurance plans, all of which he characterizes as very alarming. And he went on to say, "I don't understand how you can say owning a bunch of hospitals across the country can serve people in North Carolina better." Is he alone in that criticism?
No, although, as I said, I mean, it remains to be seen because the geographic location is so different, right? I'm not sure why it would matter, you know, Aurora Advocate is based in Wisconsin and Illinois. I don't know why that would impact prices in Charlotte and the reverse. So we'll just kind of have to see what ends up happening.
Because North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein is also a little skeptical of this. He says when hospitals merge, it usually ends up with patients paying more and getting worse care. On the other hand, Jim Skogsberg, who currently leads Advocate Aurora, the hospital system that Atrium is merging with, acknowledged that some believe big is bad, but he doesn't believe that. He says, "We think bad is bad. We think inefficient is bad. We think ineffective is bad. But we think if we do this right, we're going to get stronger and patients are going to benefit from it." Again, if the reverse of that is true, that these two are separate, distinct geographic footprints, so they will not be impacted perhaps as a merger of two equals in the same region would be impacted, how do things get stronger and better if they're distinct?
I think the argument that they would make is just more resources, right? You're combining two already really large hospital systems with a lot of employees. As you said, it's going to more than double, you know, Atrium size, and by revenue, it's going to be a lot bigger. So with more revenue comes more resources, more researchers, more doctors, et cetera. So that's what they would say.
I think Nick wants to jump in here. It looks anxious to me.
I want to follow up on the point you made about Attorney General Josh Stein voicing some skepticism, and we should note why that's important, because Stein's office notably approved the purchase of Mission Healthcare System in Asheville in the western part of the state by a for-profit company called HCA, happened a couple years ago. That has not gone well. There have been a number of reports, recently national reports, about the decreased quality of care at Mission since HCA took them over. They've got a nursing revolt on their hands. The staff has talked about decreased conditions. There is a lawsuit pending in court challenging the AG's handling and review for competitive reasons of that purchase. So Stein didn't voice skepticism for the last time we saw a major merger of hospital systems. And now he's trying to play cleanup from the fallout of that. And so it's not surprising at all that as a way of playing cleanup, he's suddenly voicing some skepticism at hospital mergers. And so that might make a rockier road, because Stein's one of three agencies that has to clear this for this merger to move forward.
And Gene Woods, once again, the CEO of Atrium Health, says the goal of this merger wasn't size. It wasn't to get bigger, but about what size enables, more investments in employees and communities and solving inequities. He said, "We're just looking to do more, better, faster." Again, not sure how that works. But what are the monetary aspects of all this? How are they accomplishing this? How much money is changing hands, and in which direction?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't know that. But, you know, the combined revenue, they say, you know, if this merger is approved, the combined revenue between the two hospitals would be, you know, more than $27 billion, which they say would make it the fifth largest hospital system. Yes. Other rankings I've seen could be even, you know, it could make them even larger than that. Where exactly they got that number is not available. So I'm not positive.
So there are some skeptics, and North Carolina State Treasurer Dale Falwell opposes this merger and called for a, quote, "vigorous examination of the combination from his office, the state treasurer's office, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, which is going to rule on this one way or the other, and the U.S. Department of Justice. So this will need regulatory approval from the FTC. What's the timeline for that? What is the likelihood of that, Claire? Do we know?
The timeline is sketchy. We don't really know. Actually, Wake and Atrium's proposed med school got hung up in regulatory review, I feel like, for a couple of years. So, you know, if you go on the timeline on the Department of Justice and FTC website, it's very optimistic, you know, like a couple, you know, 2 to 3 to 4 months, which I would be shocked. But we also, Atrium says, you know, they're hoping by the end of the year. So we'll see.
WFAE's healthcare reporter, Claire Donnelly, thanks for jumping in at the last minute to help us understand this impending merger. Appreciate it.
Sure, no problem.
Have a good one. Well, the saga over the firing of Ernest Winston as superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools continued this week. The school board held an emergency meeting. Nick, I'm going to throw you to this and ask you why.
Well, because of WFAE's Ann Doss Helms is why. Ann obtained a document from board member Ruby Jones that that was a letter from the attorney for Ernest Winston to the school board written in March in the heat of these negotiations between the Winston and the school board over his departure. And the letter from the attorney for Winston accuses the school board of violating a bunch of rules, of impeding his ability to work as superintendent, and making a bunch of accusations. And so, armed with the knowledge that WFE was going to publish that letter, which you did, the board then noticed an emergency meeting to release the response from them to that letter, which is considered under North Carolina law personnel record. So they had to go in and vote to put in a letter explaining a note in Winston's personnel file while they were releasing that.
Oh, so many questions. First of all, what was the point of Ernest Winston's attorney, Glenn Brock, sending that letter to the school board? Because are they attempting to sue the school board for wrongful termination? Or is it simply to put it on the record that he feels they did the wrong thing, they handled him the wrong way?
This was the height of the negotiations prior to him being fired. So as I've previously reported, these negotiations really started, and the process started last fall, but the negotiations of Ernest, we want you to leave, started in mid to late February and continued until his firing. And so this was in the height of that. The board was trying to get him to leave and resign willingly for an amount of money less than what they ultimately paid him. And so this was negotiating. This was one-upsmanship. You know, a crux of that letter, something that we've reported previously, that, you know, the school board in December gave Ernest Winston 5 action items on things they expected him to do or areas they expected him to improve. And this letter accused the board of interfering in his ability to be superintendent by giving him those 5 action items, among some other things. And so, no, I don't believe he has any grounds to sue because they fired him for convenience pursuant to his contract, and they paid him more than $500,000. So I don't think there will be a lawsuit.
So the emergency meeting was for the school board to vote on whether or not they would release to the public, since the private letter to the school board was released by Ruby Jones to WFAE. We published it. The meeting was for the school board to vote on whether they should publish the letter that they wrote in response to the attorney's letter. That letter was written on April the 4th. And school board members have said, or at least Dashu, the chair of the school board, said that their letter corrects incorrect statements made by Mr. Winston's attorney. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about that. And we'll also hear from Ruby Jones, who was very upset, not only by the whole exchange, but by the firing of Superintendent Ernest Winston. And we'll hear why in just a moment. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. We're here with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. Nick Oxner is with us from WBTV. He's their chief investigative reporter. Jonathan Lowe is a reporter anchor for Spectrum News One. And Eric Spanberg is the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. So the school board released, after taking a vote, they released their letter in response to Ernest Winston's previous letter. And they say it was to correct incorrect statements. What does the school board letter say?
In a very brief nutshell, that everything they did was fine, they could do what they did, and they're right in Ernest Winston's wrong.
So from the start of this, the move to dismiss Superintendent Winston had its detractors, and one of them was school board member Ruby Jones, who released that first letter, which started all this, to WFAE. When each of the school board members were given 60 seconds to speak on the matter at this emergency meeting, she was the first to talk. And she took 54 seconds to say this.
I did share with Mr. Winston's permission a letter. But likewise, Ms. Dashew brought all this ballyhoo to the board using outside sources to say that Aaronis is a good man, but not a competent man. And you might as well have spit in my face. As an older black woman, I have heard that diatribe since my youth, directed at black men especially. 52 years I've been in the education business. This has been one of the low points, I believe, as a board member. We were dedicated to positive initiatives to move our black children forward academically, behaviorally, and emotionally. This act sets our work back.
So perception is reality, and she may not be the only person with that perception, but from what we know and from the discussions that were held publicly by the school board, are any racial overtones involved in this dismissal?
You know, I think it's important to note that the vote to fire Ernest Winston was not split purely along racial lines, although the two people who voted against it were black female board members, including Ruby Jones and board vice chair Thelma Byers Bailey. But Lenora Shipp, also a black woman, also voted to fire Ernest Winston and touched on in her speech during the firing some of the same things that the white members of the school board talked about and needing to have someone who could perform better and do their job better. It's also worth noting that in the vote this week that Thelma Byers Bailey joined the rest of the board in voting to release this letter, and Ruby Jones was the only board member who opposed the release of this letter.
Jonathan.
And I'll add to that point, Mike, you know, the criticism of Ernest Winston, it didn't just start with this whole investigation of his contract. I mean, he's been at the root of a lot of criticism from some pretty outspoken activists in this community, black activists. Colette Forrest, the former head of the Charlotte Black Political Caucus, has been saying from the very beginning that, you know, she's been outright in saying that he should not have gotten this job in the first place. So I don't think, and what we have, those of us in the media that have talked to people over the course of his time as superintendent, I don't think we haven't gotten the sense that his firing or any of the, you know, the problems that people had with his leadership was along racial lines.
Steve.
I was going to say, too, I mean, don't forget, if you go to the county commission, the county commission chair, George Dunlap, Velma Leek on the county commission have been really critical of Ernest Winston. You know, Dunlap last summer speaking at an event, you know, really heavily criticized the superintendent, the former superintendent. So, yeah, I think it's just much more complicated than a black-white issue.
Who were the outside sources that Ruby Jones alleged that Elise Dashew brought in who characterized Mr. Winston as a good man but not a competent man? Was that the consultant or the coach?
So, you know, the school board hired an outside attorney to investigate Winston's performance. Best I could tell, that might be what she was referring to.
And speaking of competence, Is it Ernest Winston's competence that should be called into question here, or is it that of the school board who decided to hire somebody with no higher education degree and no higher administrative experience to run the, one of the largest school systems in the country?
Does it have to be either or, Mike?
At that emergency, and they have taken, at least Elise Dashew has said that she was aware that people were leery of this, that she knew that he would need to be coached to be successful in this job, and that they were right, the skeptics were right, and that she was wrong. So at least somebody has taken at least partial blame for this. At that meeting, school board member Rhonda Cheek characterized what they were called to the meeting to do as unfortunate, and that these documents were confidential personnel records, but one our board members have chosen to release because they wanted a wider message. Nick? As somebody who has sought information and documents on many occasions from the school system and were at least initially denied access to that information and those documents because of laws surrounding employee privacy and personnel issues, doesn't the release of this document fly in the face of those excuses, and does it set precedent for greater transparency in the future? In other words, you can't just release things that are protected by personnel laws because it's convenient for you to do so.
So I'm going to do something that will shock you and the world, and I'm going to give some kudos to the school board for releasing the personnel records that they have. And the way they released these personnel records, there's a provision in the state personnel law that says you can release otherwise private confidential personnel information simply by putting a memo in the employee's personnel file saying that the release of this information is necessary to maintain public confidence. And so that's what they did when they released the first tranche, the 30 or so pages from Winston's personnel file when they fired him. And that's again what they did this week when they released this new letter. We have tried this with Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department, saying they could use that same tact, that same provision to release use of force reports, which they incorrectly, I would argue, claim are confidential personnel records. And the city refuses to do that. We've tried with agencies all over the state to do that, and they have refused. However, we've now seen not one, but two times the Charlotte Mecklenburg School Board doing it. Look how easy it was. Look how painless it was. Look how much transparency the public gets and how much better off we are for it, because they recognized we needed to see these records to have a greater understanding of why they made their decision. It is proof of transparency and sunshine being good governance.
Okay. And speaking of Rhonda Cheek, who I just quoted a moment ago, she had an announcement of her own this week.
13 years is a very long time to serve in public office, and the last 2 years have been filled with chaos and stress, and they have taken a toll on my physical and mental health. The work itself has been time-consuming, but dealing with the ever-increasing vitriol and lack of civil discourse has compounded that stress.
So that's Rhonda Cheek announcing her decision not to run for re-election to the school board. What is the lack of civil discourse to which she referred a moment ago?
I think she's talking in large part to the mass controversy. You just remember several of the school board meetings, during the pandemic, where people would blast the school board members. And it wasn't just the school board. I mean, every public body, county commissioners, city council, not so much the city council, but more so any body that has dealt with a mask mandate, trying to put into any sort of protocols dealing with the pandemic. I mean, it was difficult watching some of those meetings.
It sounded like, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Jonathan.
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it almost sounded like what students have endured the past couple of years. You know, she spoke of anxiety, depression, sleeplessness. It was just interesting how it mirrored what so many students have been through during this pandemic.
I think the whole country might be going through a mental health crisis and not realize it because of the last 6 or 7 years of crises after crises in the news cycle. But she also cited difficulties faced by this school system and those nationwide during the pandemic, which we just talked about. Then the recent school violence, a series of Title IX issues, which Nick is very familiar with. And of course, the firing of the school superintendent, Ernest Winston. Does it surprise you that she resigned or that more have not decided to run for re-election.
I think
this is the first of what could be several announcements would be my prediction. And can you blame anyone for not wanting to serve?
Not at all.
And particularly, to your point, Nick, I'm surprised there aren't more school board, county, you know, just across the board. Because remember, all of us were covering these meetings. These meetings were going 4, 5, 6 hours. And it wasn't just once. It was week after week after week. And you're right, Mike. I think you combine that with the overall mental stress. Probably not the last person who's going to say, you know what, I need a break.
Before we move on to the city budget, Jonathan, yesterday there was to be an auction of the Epicenter, which is that downtown entertainment complex at College and Trade, which opened many years ago and for a while was a really popular spot. But the pandemic kind of did it in. It was going to be auctioned off yesterday. It didn't happen. What happened?
No, it didn't. It was, well, that's the million-dollar question the day after is why was it not auctioned off yesterday? Everybody was thinking that, you know, that it was going to be sold to, you know, the highest bidder, and that didn't happen. It was moved. The auction is now supposedly going to happen in July. But again,
on Election Day, July
26th.
Correct,
on July 26th. So hopefully that happens. You know, people probably remember Epicenter, however you want to pronounce it, from its heyday when it first opened. I mean, it was an epicenter of activity, but it has struggled. I think one of the big things prior to the pandemic was the crime issues that we had at that particular site. And I think it just scared a lot of people away from going down there. And that was kind of the beginning of the end. And as you said, the pandemic just did it in. But I know there were several interested buyers that showed up to court yesterday, ready to take on Epicenter, and it just didn't happen. And we don't really know why.
William Kirk.
But we hear that this is not unusual. Go ahead.
Well, really? It's not unusual. William Kirk, a trustee in the foreclosure, said that the auction will now be in July. There will be a minimum bid at the time. Was there no minimum bid this time? And if there wasn't, could that have been an oversight that somebody said, we can't do this. They'll buy it for a dollar.
Again, that's an excellent question, but we just really don't have those details. Okay. And I think that's for actual reason that they're trying to get the highest bidder because it's a huge property and there's a lot there. And I'm sure that there are interested stakeholders around it that really want to see such a large piece of land in the center of Uptown become something that will take us into the future.
So the city council is continuing their discussions about the 2023 budget, which comes out to a figure of $3.24 billion. It contains employee pay raises and an increase in compensation for hourly employees, something supported by the mayor, the council, for the most part, and by Marcus Jones, Charlotte's city manager, who was on this program on Wednesday.
My charge was to continue to follow the priorities of the city around affordable housing, and jobs, economic development, our corridors, but to focus on employees. How can we attract and retain our quality employees, especially our hourly employees?
This budget does that without raising property taxes, but some fees will increase by about $45 a year, Marcus Jones told us on Wednesday, for the average homeowner. One thing that seems to be the subject of some disagreement on council are suggested increases in street parking fees. Again, Marcus Jones.
We have not raised that rate since the late 1990s. It's the first rate increase in 25 years. And it's only for street parking in those two areas.
Those two areas would be Uptown and South End. The budget proposes a 50-cent per hour increase at parking meters. Raising the fees would add a $700,000 in revenue to the city. So it's a tiny amount of money in total, and it's a tiny, when you compare it to billions of dollars in the budget, and a tiny amount of money out of your pocket as a parker. Why the big brouhaha over this?
I think just because of where it is, what you just said, because it's in Uptown and South End, and particularly I think the South End aspect, and also removing Saturday as a free parking day, which the mayor has said leads to problems of people parking on Friday and not getting their car till Monday. I don't know how many people are actually doing that, but there is some concern with stores and you know, turnover of spots. But the big thing, I think, Mike, is the fact that since 1997, you haven't had an increase. And just following inflation, it would be $1.79 or something compared to a dollar.
So the mayor has said, yes.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think kind of what struck me about this budget is that, you know, this was in a way an easy budget for the city. I mean, the general fund is projected to grow nearly 5% because the city is just incredible growth here. And so when your general fund grows by nearly 5% in 1 year, that gives you a lot of options. I mean, it makes it very easy to give hourly employees raises, to give police and firefighters raises. And I think the fact that we're talking about this small parking issue, I think kind of says a lot about how this budget, there's not a lot, the city didn't have to make very many painful choices at all coming into the year.
So why muddy the waters? But the mayor has said that this slight increase will allow affordable parking, but may help discourage people, as you said, Eric, of taking up spaces for long periods of time. Councilmember Tariq Bakari, however, he's the one of the two Republicans on council, says the move doesn't make any sense. And he told WCNC-TV,
if you come out and just take the easy way out of increasing parking fees and don't figure out first mile, last mile, all the things necessary to actually use a broader system and make it work for everyone in this community, you're failing.
So is he saying we need to fix our less than ideal transit system before we raise the parking fees? Is that what he's saying?
I mean, it kind of sounded that way, but it also kind of sounded like he was talking about rideshare as well. So I'm not clear on what the fix is that he's suggesting.
All right. Yesterday, I think it was yesterday, the Citizens Review Board, Nick, voted 8-2 that disciplinary action should have been taken against the two Charlotte-Mecklenburg police officers who detained a teacher unjustly or under suspicion, but they treated her a little shabbily in June of 2021 for mistaken identity. This is rare, is it not?
Vote itself, yes. This is just the third time in the board's 25-year history that they have voted to disagree and recommend discipline. Unfortunately, Mike, and I've covered this extensively in recent years, this functionally means nothing because City Manager Marcus Jones, the other two times the board has recommended this, just sided with the police chief and said, because the police chief said that wasn't necessary, which makes you wonder, why do we have a citizens review board?
Yeah, so we don't know what the outcome of this ultimately is. Do we know when that decision will be reached?
Well, so they make recommendations to the city manager, and then it's up to the city manager whether or not to side with the review board or side with the police chief. That should all happen fairly quickly. But we just know, based on history, he'll side with the chief.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the state budget, the CMS budget, and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. Eric Spanberg is with us from the Charlotte Business Journal. Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News One and Nick Oxner from WBTV. On Wednesday, Governor Cooper proposed changes to the state government budget. His proposal on how to use $29.3 billion is one he says includes money for building construction, education inequities, affordable housing, and worker retention.
A growing state must invest wisely, save, and balance its budget. This proposal does all of that.
Like the city of Charlotte, this budget includes money for pay raises.
One of the things we're seeing is state government is experiencing what a lot of private companies are experiencing. We're getting a lot of our talent lured away by higher pay.
So, Steve, what is he suggesting in the way of pay raises?
Well, I think that I believe that the budget is expected to have, there's expected to be about a $6.2 billion surplus. The governor's proposing to spend a big chunk of that. The fight with Republicans will be over, they will want to spend less and put more in a rainy day fund, perhaps cut taxes more. The governor's budget does not do that. And of course, then the other big issue, as it always seems to be, will whether to expand Medicaid. I believe we are now one of 11 states that hasn't done that. Big priority for the governor, and Republican leadership has said that they are somewhat open to this idea. So I think that'll be the big, once again, the big debate.
Yeah, he's earmarking, the governor's earmarking some of that money to expand Medicaid to about 600,000 additional North Carolinians, which would allow more people to take advantage of affordable health care insurance for veterans, families, and children. Traditionally, the Republican-controlled legislature has said no to any attempts to expand Medicaid. Why would they be open to it now?
That's a good question. I mean, I think part of it is, like I said, that we are now, there's only 11 states left in the country that haven't done this. And there are a lot of Republican states, fully red states with red governors, red legislatures that have expanded it, like Arkansas. So we are somewhat on an island now. And I guess that there has been a sense that in places where it has been done, it hasn't been yet, or the financial disaster that a lot of conservatives have said it wouldn't be.
So correct me if I'm, help me get to understand this, because North Carolina is on a two-year budget cycle, and the two-year budget was signed and sealed and delivered last year by the legislature, and the governor signed it. Now we're 1 year into it. He's proposing changes because of unanticipated surpluses, and he wants to put that money to work. And usually when we have surpluses, particularly Republicans say, that means we've taken in too much and we need to give it back, or we need to put it in the rainy day fund. In fact, Republican House Speaker Tim Moore immediately expressed skepticism about how the governor wants to spend this money in light of potential economic downturns. And we certainly are facing inflation, and there are rumors of recession if inflation doesn't get under control. What are the chances that any of these recommendations will go through the legislature successfully?
Yeah, I see Nick is shaking his head.
He has a one-word answer, I think. Yeah.
None. Zero. I mean, and these are just suggestions. Look, this is a mid-year tune-up, and it's important to realize as we head into the short session, which I think starts next week, that this is the lawmakers hope to be there very short, out by July 4th is typically the goal. So these are, how can we reallocate this money? What do we need to tweak? I bet we will see raises for state employees. We might even see teacher raises if the governor and the General Assembly can get on the same page on that. Other than that, we've seen the General Assembly get to maybe, Republicans get to maybe on Medicaid expansion, but that's not going to happen in the short session. That's really a long session thing that I would expect to see back on the table next year.
So everybody's working on budgets. That includes Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. CMS presented very quickly, evidently, its annual budget request to the Mecklenburg County Commission this week. They're asking for a lot more money than in the past, by about $50 million more than they asked for last year. That will bring the county's portion of the school's $2.1 billion budget to $579 million. And some of that money goes to teacher pay raises and to hire more staff to help support students' social and emotional needs. After major skepticism by the commission last year over the school's handling of student performance and their plans for handling or improving student performance, at-large Commissioner Lee Altman had some words of praise for the district's commitment to improving student outcomes.
Now, here we are a year later, and what has the Board of Education done? They've done some great things. They have done some very hard work with A.J. Craybill. I have watched, I think, every single meeting they've had with him.
First thing I ought to do is buy a new sound system. But A.J. Craybill is helping to conduct the system student government-focused workshops. What have those workshops accomplished? Anybody?
It's helped the board, as someone who sat through many of them, it's helped the board focus their operations on what can we do to makes us focus on students and not on bureaucracy or petty politics crap.
Yeah.
And they touted A.J. Craybill at the CMS board touted A.J. Craybill and his involvement in the process at their budget presentation to the county commissioners as saying, look, we heard you. We're trying to fix ourselves. We're trying to be more student-centered. That being said, I'm not sure they have a lot of tangible product and tangible results that they can point to yet, other than, hey, look, we're thinking differently.
And County Commissioner Mark Jarrell was curious to know how student performance improvements would be measured.
I'm a little disconnected if we'll see a difference with respect to the percent of children that are going to be on grade level or projected to be on grade level. Are the outcomes going to be different, or we're just saying system-wide, no matter where you are?
Did he get an answer?
No, and I think, you know, Mark, for Commissioner Durrell, that's not uncommon for him to want to see metrics. He always wants to see, you know, how will this be measured? We're giving you this money. How are you going to ensure that you're meeting your goals and not just waiting to the last minute to figure out, oh, we didn't meet our goal and you've gotten all this money. You mentioned last summer's contentious back and forth between the CMS board and county commissioners. I mean, this played out over a couple of months. It was uncomfortable at moments. I remember covering the joint meeting that they finally had with George Dunlap and sitting right beside CMS chair Elise Dashew. And there were some pretty strong words that were leveled between both boards when they withheld that $56 million. And I come away now seeing this joint meeting, you know, with the budget proposal from CMS, the budget request, I should say, you come away with it asking the question of why couldn't you all have done this last summer? What in the politics statement that Nick makes is spot on, because, you know, they could have had this approach last year, bringing, you know, the commissioners asked for a plan on how they were going to address low performing schools. And it seemed CMS was just.
It was a turf war.
It was a turf yeah. war. And so now we're here many months later, and we've gotten the plan ahead of time with the budget request. They had a meeting together. At least CMS was at this meeting where they presented this request to county commissioners. And so, you know, is this more political posturing, or are we actually, as Commissioner Jarrell said, going to see some results?
So they presented their request. County Manager Dina DiIorio will present the county's budget on May the 19th, which will include whether or not the school budget will get what they want, or the school will get what they want. And we'll find out when that happens.
Well, we know the board's going to get what they want, because by law, if the county doesn't give them the stuff and they can't resolve it, then the county actually has to pay 3% more than what the district asked for. So they will get what they want. That's why it's not really a close question here.
Okay. Former Charlotte City Councilman James Mitchell resigned his seat on council a while ago, I think a year ago, because he took a job and an ownership stake in a company called Leaper Construction, which sometimes does business with the city, and his position on city council would have made that a conflict of interest, so he stepped away. But Mitchell no longer has that job at Leaper Construction and is running for council again. But Eric, yesterday you reported a new development in all of this.
So, I think a lot of us have been asking the question of, does he still own 25% of the company, which would bring that conflict of interest back into play. And he has said adamantly that he does. The company has said that he doesn't. And public records provided by the city from Leaper show that Leaper seized his 25% in March. He apparently had taken a loan from Leaper of $375,000. They demanded he repay that loan. He didn't. And they took the 25% back. But he says that is not correct, that he still owns his 25%.
Why is he running for office if he left office because of a conflict of interest?
Well, he is saying that he is willing to go below 10%, which is the state law. If you get below 10%, then there's not a problem. He's saying he's willing to sell, although he told me in the interview he would like to sell to a family member, which would seem to create another
conflict
problem.
Of interest. Yes. But would we have known that he still owned 25% of the company, or that he claims to still own that amount of the company, had this not come to light? In other words, if he stepped away for a conflict of interest and still has that conflict of interest and didn't disclose it, and he's running for office, what's up with that?
Well, look, the problem is, as my colleague David Hodges has reported for years now, Smudgy Mitchell doesn't fill out his conflict of interest forms, his state required or city required ethics forms on a regular basis. So it's hard for us to gauge these.
Why not?
Well, really, the question that you should be asking, Mike, and we should all be asking, is why isn't the city doing better policing and enforcement of those things? After David pointed it out the last time, he filed them and made some amendments that disclosed some things. But why wasn't this caught beforehand, and why isn't there greater enforcement of that? Good question.
And, you know, going back a year ago, when this deal first was announced that he would be owning 25% of the company, his plan was to just recuse himself from votes. He said, oh, I just won't vote. Well, you know, James didn't realize this, nor did anyone at Leaper or the investors didn't realize that you can't just recuse yourself. If you own more than 10% of the company, you cannot do business with the city. So it was just amazing that this multi-million dollar deal was put together without basic understanding of state law that it wouldn't be allowed.
And to Steve's point, the thing that's really important beyond any single candidate is that it's on the city. The city would have to stop doing business with the company. And in this case, Leaper Construction, who led the $127 million renovation of the Charlotte Convention Center that ended last year and is leading or part of the group that is building the $600 million renovation and expansion of the airport that's going through 2025. Can you imagine the difficulty of unwinding a deal of that size in the middle of it?
So getting a gun permit in Mecklenburg County allegedly got faster this week. Under a court order, the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office said it will now provide fingerprinting services for gun permits on a first-come, first-served basis. How does this change things?
It makes for very, very long lines. you just look at some of the video coming out of
it becomes the DMV.
Correct. Very much like the DMV. Why don't you just plan that for all one day trip, DMV and going to get your gun permit.
And the alternative to that was you were waiting in a very long, months long virtual line. Right. And that's what the lawsuit that prompted this said, look, you're effectively depriving people of their constitutional right to buy a gun, because you just can't get your fingerprints made. And so now the sheriff has said, all right, we'll have first come, first serve, but that's created good luck getting through the line.
Right, and evidently the complaint that started all this was that people would buy a gun and then not get their permit for a year afterward because of the backlog of fingerprinting and the background checks that are necessary for that. Was Sheriff McFadden deliberately dragging his feet on this, or was it something else at work here?
I recently talked to him about this, and he says the problem is not with the sheriff's office. The problem is with the FBI and the SBI and them having antiquated systems. And he says, you know, it doesn't take us long at all to process these applications, but then we have to send them off. Sometimes he said faxing these forms to the FBI and the SBI, and that the holdup is at that level, not with the sheriff's office.
There's your problem right now, faxing the forms. Does anybody have a fax machine to receive them?
I was thinking the
anymore?
Same thing as he said that. Who's got a fax machine?
Who's still, I mean, does the technology even still support it?
And so will this solve anything? I mean, if you're having a first come, first serve, you still have to file with the FBI. Does this solve anything? And are we the only jurisdiction in the country with these wait times?
A good question, but it sounds like no is the answer to that. If it's the federal level and state level that are causing the holdup, it doesn't sound like we're the only ones with that issue.
I promised that we'd touch on Madison Cawthorn. He's back in the news because the Washington Post ran an article about the Republican-led campaign to take him down, people within the party. And Cawthorn has said many times in social media that he's being targeted. He told the Washington Post, the establishment in Washington and North Carolina has fought against my reelection to Congress in a way I've never seen before. The people of Western North Carolina see through it. Our campaign is on track to win a great victory next week, no matter what comes our way. Steve, is he daydreaming or is that right?
Who knows? This will be the most fascinating race on Tuesday night to see what happens, to see if he can finish in the top two and make it to a runoff, maybe clear 30%. Just really hard to say.
And he might clear 30%. That's a very real possibility.
Okay. We have to end it there. I can't even talk about the Super Flower Blood Moon that is coming your way beginning at 9:32 on Sunday night in full bloom at 11:29, should the cloud cover allow you to see it. Steve Harrison from WFAE, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News One, Nick Oxter from WBTV, Eric Spanbrick from The Business Journal. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.